You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Tonight we talk to Oscar Award winning... Tonight we talk to award winning actress Jane Alexander. Jane Alexander received an Oscar nomination for her first film, The Great White Hope, in which she recreated her Tony Award-winning Broadway role of the white girlfriend of African-American heavyweight champion Jack Johnson, played by James Earl Jones. Jane Alexander also won Emmys for her television work. Jane Alexander is not only one of our finest actresses, but she's also an author. Her books include Command Performance, An Actress in the Theater of Politics, and her new book, Wild Things, Wild Places, Adventurous Tales of Wildlife and Conservation on Planet Earth. Jane Alexander, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Happy to be here.
Your new book really covers a lot of material. It's partially a memoir of your travels in search of beautiful wild creatures, but it's a lot more. Can you describe your inspirations, motivations for writing Wild Things, Wild Places?
Yeah, I think I can. I realized when I began to look at my journals for the past, 45 years really, that I had had a lot of trips, and I've been interested in wildlife since I was a girl and very much an outdoor girl. And I had been traveling the past 35 years with field biologists to places when they were studying their animals. And I thought that I might have something to contribute to an audience that might normally not know what is going on with field biologists, because they really are my heroes. I don't say that lightly. We don't celebrate field biologists or biologists generally in any way like we celebrate Hollywood celebrities. So I would like to somehow expose their expertise and their thoughts about the future of conservation on the world today.
Well, it's funny that you is that we don't give them. There's no Oscars for the best performance by a bird watcher and. you're so knowledgeable on so many topics. You know, you could have been Margaret Mead. I mean, if you hadn't been an award-winning actress, Did you do like a ton of research specifically for this book, or do you just know a lot of stuff?
Well, I learned a lot by hanging around scientists, but I also, yes, I read a lot. And I've been on the boards of birding organizations and Wildlife Conservation Society for quite a while now, since certainly the 80s. So I've learned a lot just that way.
Yeah. But you know, and yet you have it. I mean, you keep your journals. Is that sort of helpful?
Oh, journals are extremely helpful for capturing what was actually going on when I was there. I don't have altogether the greatest memory, but I describe things that almost go verbatim into my book, and conversations and things like that.
You know, most show business types, you know, they're usually checking into the Four Seasons, and you know. But you're out there sleeping with snakes and bugs and whatnot. What's the matter with you, Jane Alexander?
I don't know. It's true. I've been around a lot of bugs and things, but I've actually been fascinated with them for so long, and they got a bad rep, you know. The truth is, they're not as fearsome as most people think. Can some be dangerous? Of course they can. And in great numbers, of course, they can be very dangerous. But the truth is, you can sleep in a hut, some remote Amazon jungle where there are a lot of little rats, spiders, all kinds of things, and not be harmed at all. They don't go right near you, most part. Mosquitoes, yes. But.
Of course, you have bats in the living room, so...
I did have bats in the living room. In our house in Putnam County, New York, we had a cathedral ceiling, and we had put a bat house, you know, those little rectangular things outside the house. when we first moved in, and the bats moved in, and then, of course, they procreated with abandon, and pretty soon they were in our cathedral ceiling. But I did notice that there weren't any insects in the house.
Just bats.
The bats were doing a pretty good job. And, you know, they really were fine. They kept to themselves up, usually, inside the roof. But some of them would come out onto the rivets of the beams. And I became rather fond of them. Of course, I got rid of them when we sold the house, and the new couple had a baby. And the guy who removed the roof, I removed the roof and put a new roof on for them. He said he stopped counting at 120 bats.
Did you have, like, bat guano on the carpet?
Well, you know, they were pretty good. I think they were pretty house-trained for the most part. Once in a while, you'd find a little pellet here and there, but nothing major.
No, so bats are endangered now? There are fewer bats than there were?
Well, of some species. You know, we have this white nose fungus, these white fungus, that is on a little brown bat, for example. Their population has just plummeted in the past 10 years. Nobody quite knows how it began or... But I was very happy to learn, for example, I live in Nova Scotia now. This summer in Nova Scotia, suddenly there were sightings of about 10 little brown bats. So maybe they're coming back.
You're going to have to get some for your new place. I want to ask about this, and I don't know exactly how to say it. I mean, people... Apparently some people find people important too, not just animals. I don't know why that is, but people are important to some people. And, you know, there's a constant problem. That is, survival of some people depends on, say, logging or in other ways destroying the habitats of wild creatures. But the problems of survival, you know, they're still going to be there even after the extinction of the species. So what are your thoughts about dealing with, you know, population as well as preserving wildlife?
Human population, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I talk about that with my friends who remember very clearly back in the 70s, there was a big movement to try to reduce human population because we thought that it was going to take over the world. And unfortunately, I mean, in some countries, of course, the Western countries, U.S., European countries, have reduced their population because the thought was if women got enough education, they would not want to have as many babies. If they got contraceptives and they got education, they would reduce the number of children that they had. But that hasn't really come to pass in an awful lot of countries in the world. And as long as women are subjugated to the degree that they are in many countries, in Asia, Africa, and so on, it's not going to happen for a while. We're going to hit 10 billion by 2050.
And what will that mean for large mammals other than humans?
Well, most of the large mammals have been on the road to extinction for quite a while. We're trying to save them because they're too wonderful to let go. But it's going to be harder and harder. For example, by the end of the century, 1 in 4 children is going to be an African child, and that means they have to be fed, and China and India also are going to have significant population growth still, and the world has got to feed them, and Africa has an awful lot of land that's arable, and the animals will be sacrificed.
So it's just inevitable, you believe?
Well, it's inevitable for great amounts of territory. However, we can put aside sanctuaries, which is what we're doing already. We're making parks like Kruger Park in South Africa has a thriving population of Africa's wildlife, even though some of the rhinoceroses, southern white rhino, are still being poached at an alarming rate for their horns. We can have viable parks that will protect these animals, and we can hire people who will enforce the anti-poaching. And that's happening in many places in the world. Look at the parks in Nepal, which they bring the army in to protect against poachers. But it's not going to be the same as animals roaming free and not getting hurt.
Well, so what's your stand on zoos and circuses? I mean, there's one argument that says, well, that brings those animals and people can see them, and then they have a greater appreciation for them. And then there's the other argument against them. Where do you stand?
I know. Well, you know, I've been involved with zoos for a very long time, since I was asked to be on a trustee of the Wildlife Conservation Society. And I then began to go to a zoo in almost every city I found myself in to learn a little bit more about them. There are good zoos, and there are the zoos that really do not care for their animals properly. I understand the argument against having zoos, but I also think that if there are orphaned animals in the world, and there's many of them, and you can bring them into zoos, and people who never get privileged to see them in the wild will learn about them. It's also true today, of course, elephants, I have to just make, elephants are social animals and work best, live best, thrive best in family groups. So it's very hard to keep a large family group of elephants in a zoo. Of course, there's wonderful wildlife parks that one can do that.
Now, what about speaking of elephants? What about circuses and?
Well, the circuses are phasing out, as you know.
Right. This is like the last year of elephants or something, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And is that something that you think is a good thing?
Yes, I actually do. I mean, I will miss those wonderful shows that I would look forward to every year as a child. But the truth is, we have them on film. We don't really need to see the elephants doing these tricks, which are very demeaning to the animals, yeah. And they have to be trained to do them, and the training is not nice.
Yeah.
So I'm just as happy not to see them. I'm just happy to see human beings risking their lives on trapezes and things, but they do it with free will.
Well, you and I remember, you know, lots of trained chimpanzees that used to be on television on the Jack Benny Show or whatever. We don't see that as much anymore, which is, I guess, a good thing.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, I think we're beginning to understand it. Oh, chimps, orangutans, gorillas, a lot of the large primates rank among the most intelligent creatures in the world. Currently, orangutans and chimpanzees, along with dolphins.
And elephants, right?
And elephants, and ravens.
Yes, you were talking about ravens in your book.
Yes, I love ravens.
I wonder if they've ever tried any, maybe you know, have they tried language research or communication, interspecies communication with ravens?
No, I don't know if they try to make them talk. That's something interesting. I know that they taught them, in order to understand their intelligence, they give them tasks to do, and the ravens always surprise them. Typically, they catch on.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking with Jane Alexander. Her new book is called Wild Things, Wild Places, Adventurous Tales of Wildlife and Conservation on Planet Earth. We're talking with actress Jane Alexander, who's just written a book called Wild Things, Wild Places, Adventurous Tales of Wildlife and Conservation on Planet Earth. You told an interesting story in your book about I can't remember if it was your granddaughters, but you passed by these beautiful Galapagos tortoises that were in captivity, and they raced past them to go look at the video.
Yes, that was a friend of mine. Her kids. Isn't that surprising? Here were these incredible Galapagos tortoises, the most remarkable species of tortoise in the world, large and. They were brought all the way from the Galapagos to this museum's exhibition. And the girls walked right by them. The mother was shocked, and they went right to the video of the very same animals. And the girl said, well, you know, I think it was a mistake to bring all the tortoises all those way from the Galapagos, because the story is told better on the video.
It's weird, isn't it?
Well, it's a new generation also. I mean, this is how they're very visual, and they're very two-dimensional visual.
Well, as an actress, how do you feel about that? I mean, when you make a movie, you expect that movie's going to be seen in a dark room with 300 or 500 people who are sharing the experience. Whereas in actuality, that isn't the way people see movies anymore. They watch them on their phone, or they're looking at their phone while they're at the movie. Or...
Yes, yes. Oh, it's so different. I can't watch them on the small screen. Everything in my mind gets very reduced. I love the big screen experience. But let's talk about what does it do to theater?
Yeah.
You know, my first love and probably my last love will be live theater. But there's been an enormous change, even in New York, in live theater, because most of it is the sensationalist stories, musicals, rather than the smaller dramas. That
musicals based on movies and cartoons.
Yes, right, exactly. Yep. Disney has another new one coming out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that is interesting. I mean, the way people, you know, the smaller plays. You know, when you did The Great White Hope, that was in a sort of a small house, wasn't it?
Well, it began in Washington, D.C., in a theater in the Round at Arena Stage. And then when it moved to Broadway, it was in a big Broadway theater with a balcony and everything. And that was not a small drama. That was an epic piece about... racism, very germane to the times, because the Black Power movement, 1968, was at its height, and it was just a fascinating play to be a part of. We also had, in that production, we had 63 actors, and it was a straight play. It was not
a musical.
And 40 of those were African Americans, and so. It was quite a remarkable experience. They were playing, 63 actors playing over 200 roles.
Well, I remember that year on the Tony Awards on TV, you and James Earl Jones did a scene, and he kissed you, which I imagine was probably not as shocking on the stage as it might have been on television. Was there a reaction to that television broadcast?
Not that they ever told me. But I had had a lot of reaction, my being involved with a black man on stage when we were doing the production, and the male was not nice, a lot of it. So I didn't, after a while, I just asked the stage manager to read it, and I asked not to tell me anything. Too discouraging.
Most actresses, if you don't mind talking about your acting career a little bit, most actresses, you know, if you look at their resumes, you know, they did a million TV shows, they were on, you know, Dr. Kildare or whatever, and then all of a sudden they get a good part. But it seems like you just suddenly appeared in The Great White Hope. Had you done a lot of things before that we didn't see?
Oh, no, I hadn't really done any, I hadn't done any TV or movies then. Maybe one or two, I'm forgetting, but Great White Hope went on then to be a movie, and James Earl Jones and I both got Academy Award nominations for our performances, and that really then changed everything for me. Then from then on, I got movies and a lot of TV work as well.
So you just entered as a star. That seems unusual.
I think it was very unusual at the time, very unusual. And I was very happy always with my career, because I had a lot of choices. I was very privileged. I had theater as choices, off-Broadway, Broadway regional theater was always open to me, and then small movies, big movies, TV movies. I did very few series because I got sort of locked into that TV movie area back in the 70s, and of which there were a great many.
Yeah, it was like the golden age of the miniseries.
Yes, yes.
And you were, so you on TV, you've played both Franklin Roosevelt's wife and his mother.
know, not at the same time.
It's kind of cool. Well, you've worked, so you've worked, and I want to ask you a question about acting, because you've worked on the stage, and you've worked in movies, and you worked on television. And I've always been fascinated by the fact that certain actors are really successful on TV and not so successful in the movies, and other actors are very successful in the movies and not so successful on TV. Is there a difference in the acting in those three mediums, stage, television, movies?
I think Dustin Hoffman said it best when he told me, I was doing a play, and I can't remember what it was, and also shooting, was it Kramer versus Kramer, I believe, at the same time. And I would come from the theater matinee and maybe go and do a couple of scenes. I don't remember quite how it worked, but one day Dustin came up to me, it was my close-up, and he whispered in my ear and he said, stage hangover. And I knew just what he meant. He said it was too big. So for the big screen, you don't have to do very much. And I don't think you have to do very much on television either. I think it's virtually the same as our television screens at home now are so big.
Oh, now, yeah, yeah. But when I saw you in Eleanor and Franklin, it was in black and white on like a 14-inch show.
Oh, it was actually in color, though, Gary.
It was, but I didn't have a color TV.
Oh, you didn't have it.
Yeah, not in my room, you know. But so you think movies and TV are pretty similar?
Oh yeah.
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 Well, you do. You tend to do a lot of TV now. I saw you in quite a few Good Wives. I always got a thrill when you came on.
Oh, thank you. Well, I did play that judge, interesting judge for a few years, yes. But, you know, the truth was I haven't done so much television lately. I've been very, very involved in wildlife and conservation for wildlife, so I don't have a lot of time to do both.
Well, it seems like all the things you've done are full-time jobs. You were also head of the National Endowment for the Arts, or the president of, what was the actual title that you had?
That was it.
Yeah.
Chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts.
So after that experience and all the things you've been doing with wildlife, were you ever tempted to be a politician, go into politics?
No, I really wasn't. I think, you know, when I played Eleanor Roosevelt, people get confused.
Yeah, they think you are Eleanor Roosevelt.
I literally, after the series was so heralded, I got a call from the Democratic Party asking if I would like to run for state offices or something. I said, no, I'm really, that's Eleanor Roosevelt on film, that's not me. But then when the time came for the National Endowment for the Arts, which was really having a terrible problem, during the early 1990s with some grants that Congress were finding egregious.
This was during the Mapplethorpe controversy?
Yeah, Mapplethorpe and Serrano.
Uh-huh.
Serrano. So, and then the NEA4, the performing artists, Karen Finley and Tim Miller and two others. So, yeah, it was a tough time, and they were looking for somebody who would feel very comfortable standing up for the freedom of expression, the First Amendment rights. And I said, you know, I don't have any problem with that, because as an actress, I've always believed nothing human is alien to me. So I'm happy to take it on and try to protect it and try to protect the artist's visions. It doesn't mean that we have to give grants as a government organization to everybody for everything. It has to be carefully juried. But I was, so that's what my job was for those 4 years.
To actually do the jurying?
No. The jurying was done by panels of their peers.
Uh-huh.
And very highly recognized people, I might add. George Plimpton, for example, was one of the chairs of a panel for novels one time. And there were 350 or so submissions, and that panel read all of them, between the 12 of them, with George Plimpton as their chair. It was remarkable.
Well, so have you kept a hand in since you left that post, or are you happy not to be involved?
Oh, I always keep a hand in. There's some wonderful people who are, Jane Chu is chairman now, and she's a remarkable leader of the endowment and what it stands for. And I keep on involvement with arts and arts education. But my, as I say, you know, Gary, my whole life right now, because we're at a critical point with so many animals declining so quickly. I mean, you know, you've got 96 elephants a day being killed. So this is my focus for probably the rest of my life, is trying to find a way for human beings with all of our problems and our needs for development and energy systems to coexist with these animals and make it possible for them somehow to make it to the 21st century. You know, and we're talking about the great mammals, and everybody knows this now, tigers, and but no, maybe not many people know that lions of all the great cats are in extreme trouble right now. They're being killed so quickly.
And that's because people are hunting them, or because their environment is shrinking, or both?
It's both. It's both. But they're being hunted, you know, wild tigers. We're down to about 3,500 tigers in the wild right now, and only about 1,000 breeding females. So when tiger parts began to be scarce for the medicinal market in China, Vietnam, Indonesia, and so on, then they start turning to other cats, lions in particular. And then lions are also being hunted because they're moving on to agricultural grounds and taking some of the domestic animals of the natives there. So, you know, it's a real problem.
Do they actually serve any medicinal purpose?
Well, not really, no. There's, you know, there may be trace minerals in anything, like there might be in human flesh as well. But no, there is no earthly reason why these creatures should be killed. You can make synthesized medicine. And that's, by the way, there's a lot of people trying to do that right now. For example, I just found out yesterday that there's a company that's going to start synthesizing rhino horn, making it look so real, the whole horn or parts of it, so real that they feel that even the experts won't be able to tell the difference. And they're going to flood the market with it, hoping that the price will come down. Right now, a big rhino horn can go be sold for $100,000. So that kind of price will just kill all of the rhinos eventually.
Right, so if you flood the market with fake ones that you can't tell the difference, then the price would go down and people would stop killing them.
That's the idea. Now, this is controversial. Some people feel it's pie in the sky. Others feel it's worth a try.
Well, could you do the same thing with ivory? Could you synthesize ivory and save the elephants that way?
Probably, but I think ivory, it may be a little bit harder. Elephant ivory, I don't know the answer to that, Gary.
Well, because you do talk about, in your book about how, you know, the consciousness about fur really did, I mean, you hardly ever see anybody wearing fur, especially in the West Coast. I think maybe in the East Coast a little. But furs are gone, pretty much.
Well, they're certainly gone from the United States. But you will still see them in Russia.
Mm.
And there's a lot of women in Eastern Europe who still wear furs. So we're not out of the woods yet with animals, wearing animals. Maybe they don't have great companies over there that sell all these wonderful, you know, synthetic down or down jackets.
Or activists with red paint, cans of red paint.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it was a lot of it was about education, right?
Yes, absolutely. And the red paint wasn't to be annoying; it was to bring attention to the problem, which they did. And by the way, there were a lot of laws passed in the in those years. I'm trying to think which years they were, the 70s?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that made it possible for a lot of animals to have a chance.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're talking with Jane Alexander. She's an actress, but also a conservationist and wildlife expert who's written a book called Wild Things, Wild Places. Well, your book is kind of in two parts. I mean, it's divided into several parts, but the first part is you traveling around with naturalists and seeing all kinds of animals and swimming with sharks and all that stuff. And then you sort of talk all about all of the threats and ecological situations that we're in with animals.
Yes, and then I also talk. I have the chapter Killers is also talking about the habitats of animals and what is killing them.
Right, and we're all killers to some degree. Even you and me.
That's right. Well, we all are. Yeah. No matter. I mean, I have a lot of wonderful friends who are very careful with their diet and vegans and everything, but we all actually are killing in one way or another. None of us gets a free pass on this planet. We are changing the equation of the earth with every meal and every footprint. So that's the way of the world. That's life.
Well, you do talk about a people, and I'm sorry, I don't remember which people it was.
But the Bhutanese.
The ones that eat meat, blood, and milk.
Oh, well, that's the Maasai.
Oh, the Maasai, right. And you said you were looking at their teeth thinking.
Oh, my gosh, they're quite gorgeous, those men and women. And the ones I saw had absolutely perfect teeth, and I thought, oh, my gosh, is that the diet? I wish I had that then.
But you are a meat eater. You're not a vegetarian or a vegan or...
I'm not a vegetarian, although I can go for months and have sometimes eating vegetarian meals very happily. Ultimately, I think my cellular structure is so old, it requires that little bit of meat once in a while.
What about your hiking boots? Are they leather?
You know, my favorite ones are, but I'm wearing them out, so I'm probably going to switch to... my less favorite ones, which are all synthetic.
Well, I liked it in your book when you talk about marvelous animal sightings. Oh, I wanted to bring up one thing before I get to that. You also were saying that it kind of relates to what we're talking about, the rhino horns and the ivory, that the shark fin soup has to be chicken soup to give it flavor.
Yes, isn't that ironic?
The shark fin has absolutely nothing, doesn't add anything to it.
No, it's just a gelatinous substance that it's beyond me why you would need to kill the sharks to get it. But I think that's going to change too, though. I mean, you have countries like the Bahamas which to preempt the Chinese tourists, which are beginning to come in droves and demand shark in soup. And Bahamas has enormous numbers of sharks, preempted them by banning all shark fishing for certain waters.
Yeah. From now on, forever.
Yeah.
And you swam with sharks? You weren't afraid? They were all swarming around you?
I thought I would be terrified, but I was the first one in the Galapagos to jump in the water. And I was, as the English say, gobsmacked. I could not. I would have gasped if I didn't have a pipe in my mouth. And it was stunning. Maybe 50 sharks, white tip, black tip, and then below them hammerheads, just drifting by me, swimming right by me, back and forth, all around. And this isn't a confined area. This is out in the ocean, Galapagos Islands. But it was extraordinary. They certainly had eaten well. They certainly weren't interested in me.
That was very lucky, I would think.
Yeah.
And you held the poisonous frogs, and you weren't afraid they were going to... I mean, you said that you were holding a frog that could kill 10 people.
No, I don't remember that.
Oh.
I mean, I didn't hold one.
Oh.
I certainly saw a number of poison dart frogs in the Amazon.
Yeah.
But I've never held
one. You stayed away.
Oh, okay, good.
And I never held a Gila monster either. I wouldn't do that.
No. Good. Well, otherwise we wouldn't be talking, I think.
No, we wouldn't. I came very close to being bitten by a number of snakes, but...
Oh, talk about that one when you were in the tree. Tell that story.
Oh, the one in Africa?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Okay, so our guide said, I want to take you to see some owls in a big old baobab tree. The baobab was an old hollowed-out tree, naturally dead and hollowed out, 12 feet across on the inside. And so we entered, I did, and the guide, my husband was outside taking pictures, in a little two-foot-wide hole, and went in, and it was open to the sky, and there were no owls, and my husband said, go back further, so I can take a picture. Keep going back, so I have good depth perception. I went back, and as I got to the back of the wall of the inside of this tree, a big body slithering down my right shoulder, heavy as can be, and landed on the floor, and I screamed, Black Mamba, Mamba! Because I didn't know any other snake's name at that time. And it just, poor little thing, it went outside. I mean, it wasn't so little. It was about 7 feet long, but it went right out the hole where my husband was. He got up and screamed. And our guide said, oh, my gosh. And then the guide got a good look at it and said, this was not a Black Mamba, so that was good.
The snake probably ran off and said, Calamity Jane came and knocked me down.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. So, what when you see some, you know, fantastic creature, what is it as thrilling as an ovation on stage? Which is greater?
That's a hard one because there's such different parts of my brain and viscera that respond. I think. So when I'm doing it on stage, it's something that I've created, a character, or with the help, of course, of the writer, director. And so it's something of mine. But when I'm seeing an animal that is one of the great creatures of the creator, it's entirely different. Now, I will say that because I've studied animals for so long, and especially birds, I know what I'm looking at.
Mm.
So then I get a very special thrill. For the most part, I know what I'm looking at.
You never have the urge to grab them and kill them and stuff them and put them in your house?
No.
Well, but for so long, that was what it meant to go, you know, to be a bird watcher or to go birding and collecting them or collecting. You think of collecting wildlife as having seen it. You saw a lion, you saw a tiger, you saw a black mambo.
Yeah, and taking pictures.
Mm.
Yeah, we shoot with cameras, not guns. Most of us, not anymore. And I do have a bone to pick with collectors. I mean, I think there's over-collecting, and there's an incredible black market trade in collection as well. And I do talk a little bit about that with the reptiles of the world.
Yes.
But for the most part, most reptiles that you see shows, reptile shows or in pet stores, they're legitimate and they're captive bred for the most part. But you always should ask somebody before you think about purchasing one, or even when you're in there. I go in pet stores and I say, oh, where'd you get this gecko from? You know, not a bad idea just to question them and see if they're legit.
Yeah. Is there a lot of that going on, black market reptile capture?
Enormous. It's a wonderful book called The Lizard King that actually going to be made into a movie, I think, and I hope, that it's just got the underground mafia for reptile trade from Southeast Asia, just makes it thrilling to read.
Well, just tell us about some of the creatures that you've seen that you said, oh my God, I can't believe I'm seeing this.
Well, of course, I I wanted so much when I was in Bhutan to see the Manal pheasant, which has 13 different colors. And it's a high mountain bird. And finally, one dawn morning, we were up there, a few of us. There was an old monk in a monastery eating some Manal pheasants that had come out of the forest. And one big male hopped up on the bank 100 feet with a little, came by 100 feet from me, and then in the bright sunlight, I caught a picture of him. I made it. I was so stunned I could hardly move. And then I put my camera down, and that bird walked right into my shadow. He came within a few feet of my feet. I didn't move. I didn't breathe at all. It was stunning. It was stunning. He, in the sunlight, he was so glowing. He was trembling with iridescence. And it, I couldn't have had a more gorgeous sight of anything in the whole world. I was so happy.
That's, it's thrilling. It really is. I'd love to go there. But, you know, you have to travel. I'm not that into travel. You have to go places. It's very uncomfortable.
Yes, well, yeah. And sometimes the actual, the, you know, where you spend the night is not the most comfortable thing either.
Yeah. Do you still plan to travel the world, or are you done with your travels?
No, I'm not done with my travels. I don't think I'll ever be done with my travels, Gary.
Where have you not been that you need to go?
Well, you know, I'm a, birding is my thing, so I just, there's so many birds in South America that I just got to go back there. I mean, I was in Colombia last March, I believe it was, and I just have to go back there again as soon as possible, because Colombia has now got the peace accord, even though the referendum didn't work out quite the way. There's not going to be any more real war there. And it's really opened up to everybody. It's going to be safe. It is safe because it was safe when we were traveling there last spring. And Colombia has what I think it's verging on 2,000 bird species. There's only 10,000 in the world.
Do you keep a count of how many species you've seen?
I used to. That's called listing.
Yeah.
And most of my friends are listers, but after a while, I got tired of it. It's like, I just thought, I don't really need to list all of you. Now, I do, I shouldn't say that. I always mark down what I saw, and I'll keep a journal about what I saw. And I post on, there's something called eBird, which is an incredible online checklist that's run by Cornell Lab. And anybody can join eBird, and you can just document your birds that way. I do all that, but so I guess I am a lister. But I don't celebrate my lists. I'm not going for 8,000. One of my friends about to hit 8,000 birds. Great.
How many do you think you? Where are you in your?
Oh God, I really don't know. I would say probably 3,000.
You got a ways to go then.
I got a. Yeah, I do. I'm not going to get there.
There are some very beautiful photographs in the book, too, I should mention. That,
thank you.
Yeah, they're just great. Not just, there's photo sections, but then throughout the book you have wonderful little pictures, too.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I've used the same camera for many, many years. I feel very comfortable with it. It's not the greatest for taking bird pictures because you have to have a 400 or a 600 millimeter lens to really get great pictures, but I work out fine with my little 200 millimeter.
And you don't have a co-writer. You write your own books?
Yeah.
And it's a beautifully written book, and it's called Wild Things, Wild Places, Adventurous Tales of Wildlife and Conservation on Planet Earth, which is my favorite planet, by the way, so far.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
And the author is my guest, Jane Alexander. Really a thrill to have you on the show. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you, Gary.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I want to thank my guest, Jane Alexander. Her new book is called Wild Things, Wild Places, Adventurous Tales of Wildlife and Conservation on Planet Earth. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we'll see you next time.